9-year-old Evelyn Dekos, Callie Scruggs, and William Kinney, as well as 61-year-old Cynthia Peake, 60-year-old Catherine Kuntz, and 61-year-old Mike Hill. Their lives were cut tragically short, and we grieve with their families and loved ones.
Nashville area pastor Jared Smith. He spoke during a vigil last night for the victims of Monday's deadly shooting at the Covenant School. Another tragic entry on America's ever-growing list of deadly mass shootings. Another flashpoint in the culture war over gun control. We're not going to focus on gun control today, though, but the guns themselves. One gun in particular, the AR-15, a style of rifle that's been used in most of the deadliest mass shootings in the last decade. The shooter in the Nashville school attack had at least one. The Washington Post has an extensive look at the history of that gun, how it migrated from the hands of troops on the battlefield into those of everyday Americans, and how its popularity surprised many, even gun industry executives themselves. Todd Frankel is an enterprise reporter for the Washington Post. Hi, Todd.
Hi.
So an AR-15 is a style of rifle, right? Nearly every gun company makes some version, their own version of one. So when we use this term AR-15, can you tell us what exactly we're talking about?
Yeah, that's one of the trickier things, right? It is like the term assault rifle. So an AR-15 generally is a rifle that has a long barrel, has an extended magazine very often. So a magazine that holds like 10, 15, 20, 30 bullets at a time. You know, if anyone thinks about the military's M16, that sort of rifle, what they call in the industry a black rifle, it looks distinct and different from what you might think of as your grandfather's wood-stocked hunting rifle. It's certainly not a handgun. It is that in-between sort of militarized looking rifle that we now unfortunately see on the news all the time.
And the AR-15 is basically the civilian version of the M16, this military rifle, right?
Yep.
And the AR-15 is now the best-selling rifle in the U.S. Roughly 1 in 20 Americans owns at least one of them. So what about this style of rifle makes it so uniquely popular?
It's a recent phenomenon, right? So it's really in the last 20 years since the assault weapons ban that U.S. used to have expired in 2004. And then the big gun companies got behind it. And it is hailed and loved by gun owners because it is easy to fire, even though it is a military rifle that it doesn't have much of a kick, right? So when you fire it, it doesn't like hit your shoulder like hunting rifles. Some hunting rifles will really hurt to shoot.
Right.
This one doesn't hurt to shoot. It's fun. It's popular. And it, you know, its look is sort of attractive. You know, if you think about what folks look for in video games and that sort of trendy black rifle appeal. It's incredibly popular.
And yet it's also the weapon used in 10 of the 17 deadliest U.S. mass shootings since 2012. And getting shot with an AR-15 or a bullet from an AR-15, it's not the same as being shot with a handgun. Can you describe, I guess, how it's different?
Getting shot by a bullet from an AR-15, although it's a very small bullet, it's called a .223. It has a lot of force behind it. It moves incredibly fast. And when that small bullet hits a body, it sends a shockwave, blows a hole inside of the body that's much bigger than what you would see from a shotgun slug, a handgun. So, you know, actually, even though the bullet is smaller from an AR-15, the damage that you see inside, and it's what trauma surgeons talk about, is just so much worse than getting shot by a handgun.
So I want to get into the history of the AR-15 a little bit. The prototype for the gun was invented in the 1950s by a company called Armalite, which at the time was based right here in L.A. Pretty surprised to learn that in Hollywood. What was Armalite's original intent for this weapon?
So Armalite was a tiny little company, and they were looking to develop a gun for the military because the military was looking to replace its World War II era rifles. And so the Pentagon asked for, you know, U.S. to come up with its own version of it, basically the AK-47. And Eugene Stoner, who's worked at Armalite back then, designed the AR-15, which stands for Armalite Rifle Version 15.
Right. So it does not stand for assault rifle, which I think is a common misconception.
Yep.
And so you mentioned Eugene Stoner. He is deceased, but you spoke to some colleagues of his, and they told you he would never have approved of civilians using AR-15s like this. Why not?
He died in 1997. And back then, you know, the gun was, the assault weapons ban was still ongoing. And he actually thought that the AR-15 was about to be surpassed. It was about to be forgotten. He thought, well, There's no domestic market for it, no civilian market, because it really wasn't being sold to civilians in great numbers. And the military would probably move on. What he never foresaw was that demand for the AR-15, you know, they would ever become the best-selling rifle in America. I mean, he had no interest in seeing that happen, and it just was inconceivable to him back then.
So when does that start to change then? I mean, at least from a public policy standpoint, the decision to allow the AR-15 to even be bought by average civilians was the end of the federal assault weapons ban back in 2004. So when then do we see the gun industry start to realize the potential of the civilian market for these styles of rifles?
It was only in 2006, a couple of years later, when Smith & Wesson, like, you know, everyone knows the name Smith & Wesson, whether they like guns or not. It's a storied brand. It's been around, you know, since the 1800s. When they decided to make their very first long gun, and it was an AR-15, that was a watershed moment of saying, all right, the big makers, the big boys in the gun industry are going to get behind this. And slowly but surely, you know, it started to take off.
And then you said 2006. Now, flash forward to 2008, leading up to the election of President Barack Obama. His election also proved to be a catalyst for sales. How come?
Yeah, that's another thing that came up in our report. It was really interesting. The AR-15 sort of serves as a barometer of fear. Its sales jump much more than other guns. Each time there is a contentious election, the prospect of new gun laws, or a mass shooting. So every time, you know, when Barack Obama was elected in 2008, you know, folks were talking, the NRA was very worried about, you know, new gun regulations. Oh, Democrats in the White House. And they use this both to sell guns and also because they are generally worried about new gun laws. But then we also saw this in 2012, right? When after the horrific Newtown mass shooting in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, where they had, you know, the prospect of new gun laws come up there, and AR-15s flew off the shelves. You know, they, gun stores were literally picked clean of any AR-15 inventory they had.
So going back a little bit, not everyone was happy about how the AR-15 was being sold to the public in the, you know, mid, not aughts, but between around like 2000, I guess between Obama's election and between in the lead up to Sandy Hook. You talked to a former marketing executive for Smith & Wesson, a man named Harry Falber. And tell us a little bit about his story and his unease with how the gun industry really leaned into kind of the militarization and glorification of marketing these weapons.
Yeah, Harry Falber was like this, as he said, he grew up in the madman era of advertising. So he came from like traditional advertising. He worked for like Volvo, Hallmark. I mean, he was, you know, a blue chip guy working for ad companies. And he started to work for Smith & Wesson, and he didn't really know guns. I mean, he owned a gun actually, but wasn't familiar with it. And so he was surprised. I mean, he thought that guns could be marketed just like any other consumer product. But he was surprised and sort of worried by what he saw as the direction of the gun industry, where this dark nature of their marketing, where, you know, he had no problem selling guns, you know, stressing craftsmanship or the sort of, you know, the strong history. He worked for Smith & Wesson, so they had a very strong brand name. He wanted to emphasize that. And what he found, according to him, is that, you know, executives there were less interested in doing that and more stressing the sort of the fact that military use this, the fact that SWAT teams use this to sort of sell up the darker aspects. And I think the culmination of that was the an ad by another gun maker, Bushmaster, who put out this ad that said, consider your man card reissued. And that was for an AR-15 that ended up being used in that Sandy Hook school shooting. I spoke to other gun executives, former gun executives, who, you know, if you didn't like the direction of the gun industry, there wasn't really a place for dissent or disagreement. You either got on board or you got out. You were quickly shunned if you put up any sort of disagreement. And this darker sort of advertising is this, you know, we actually did, one of our stories was looking at the marketing changes for the AR-15 alone. And you can really sense that it went from this sort of, you know, if you were to think about the gentleman gun owner back in the day hunting or even home for home protection, getting a handgun. The AR-15 was advertised and marketed in a very different way where, you know, you were sort of cast as a soldier or some looming threat, or there was an aggressiveness that made lots of people very uncomfortable.
So sales of AR-15s are now driven by the division in our country. 2020 was the most successful year of business for Smith & Wesson in its 169-year history. Where do you see the gun industry then going forward on this? I mean, the CEO of Smith & Wesson now vocally defends the AR-15 after mass shootings. What does this tell you?
Yeah, I mean, Smith & Wesson's change is a great example, because they at one point were probably one of the more mainstream gun companies. You know, like they didn't even make an AR-15 for so long. They at one point were probably one of the more progressive in terms of working with federal authorities on gun regulations. That this happened in the year 2000. Once word got out, they were quickly walked away from a deal with the White House. And then now they won't even turn up to like testify before Congress or even talk to, you know, regulators or Congress about this.
And that gets at this idea that the AR-15 is now, it's more than a gun. It's a symbol for gun rights. I mean, how does that make it harder to regulate, harder to discuss ideas like reducing the capacity of these guns? I mean, these policy proposals that, you know, theoretically could have some debate, I mean, they just get shut down.
You know, increasingly I heard lots of people talk about the AR-15 as the modern day musket, right? And when you put it on that level, when you put it right there as almost belonging in the Constitution, as if the Second Amendment mentions an AR-15, it makes it very difficult to talk about any way to moderate. You know, the stakes are so high and the rhetoric is so heated that the AR-15 has become like this perfect metaphor for, you know, a lot of the polarization in the country.
So President Biden, once again, is urging Congress to ban assault weapons after this week's shooting in Nashville. Long term, what is the reality that could ever happen? And in the meantime, you know, you mentioned how sales of these weapons spike every time there's a mass shooting or every time there's this reinvigorated perception that an assault weapons ban could be put into place. Does that only make AR-15s more popular in the meantime?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's instructive to look about what happened after Sandy Hook, right? I mean, folks were like, well, this is going to change things, right? And it didn't, right? The assault weapons ban came up for a vote and it failed, right? Even some Democrats voted against it. You know, the stakes are so high that it's hard to imagine, you know, if not on a federal level, you know, the states will take it and go in different directions as well.
Well, Todd, thank you so much for joining us on the show. And thank you so much for your reporting.
Oh, thank you.
Todd Frankel is an enterprise reporter for The Washington Post. It is the final day of KCRW's spring pledge drive. That's a mouthful. You've been hearing it all day. So what are you waiting for? I mean, really, what are you waiting for? Be a part of this vibrant community that makes KCRW possible. You know, we've been talking about this, all of the work that goes into the shows like Press Play, like Greater LA, like Morning Becomes Eclectic, all of the DJs, so much work has to go into all of these shows. There are teams around us making all of this possible. So please donate now, kcrw.com/give. We are so close to making our spring fundraising goal, but we need you right now to take us over the finish line. That's right. We need you. And there isn't a lot of time left. Please give right now. Only a few hours left to have your donation bumped up by $100. $100. That's a lot. And that's going to go a long way to helping us. KCRW champions Will Farrell, you know Will Farrell, and Vivica Paulin Farrell are providing the cash, but only if you give now. So please, kcrw.com/give. That's kcrw.com/give. Coming up, the FDA moves to make the overdose reversing drug Narcan available over the counter. How it could help fight the increasingly devastating opioid epidemic. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Alloy. The FDA announced today it will make the life-saving medication Narcan available over the counter. Narcan is a nasal spray version of the generic drug naloxone. It can quickly revive a person from an opioid overdose. And right now, it's mostly available through a pharmacy or certain nonprofits. But by this summer, you should be able to get it at supermarkets, gas stations, online, even at a vending machine. Joining me now to discuss this is Keith Humphreys. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University. Welcome back to Press Play.
Great to be back.
So the U.S. saw more than 100,000 overdose deaths both last year and the year prior. The overwhelming majority of them are from opioids. Given how dire this crisis is right now, why has it taken so long to make Narcan available over the counter like this?
I'm sure it's really frustrating to people when you see the deaths mounting up, but there's a lot of regulatory work to go on before a drug can be judged safe to go out of prescription and into over-the-counter. And there's a lot of checks of safety. Also need to work out some things about the economics. You know, will the drug be priced at a point people can get it? And will it be priced at a point that someone will produce it? So that's why it takes so long.
Narcan is available at most pharmacies right now, but what are the existing barriers to getting it for the average person who may need it?
Yeah, so right now, effectively, we all have a prescription for Narcan, which means we can go to a pharmacist and say, I want this drug either for myself or for someone like I care about that I want to save. This would take the pharmacist out of the equation. You would not have to do that anymore. You could just pick it up like you can pick up an aspirin, and you wouldn't even have to buy it at a pharmacy. You could buy it at a supermarket or a gas station. And it's also possible we could start having it out more available in non-healthcare settings. Like, you know, we could have naloxone in, say, bars where sometimes people have overdoses and it would just be there, kind of like a fire extinguisher in case we need it. That's all legal now when a drug is over the counter.
And has the FDA laid out a timeline for when this kind of more widespread availability will happen?
It should happen later this year, and it's only going to cover a particular type of product, a nasal spray. There'll still be other ones that are still prescription, and some of the manufacturers will have to change some things. But it should be in place probably by, I would say, the end of the summer.
So you mentioned the price. I mean, at this point, how much does a dose, a dispenser of naloxone cost?
It's actually cheap to make because it's generic, but the price varies widely around the country. So some people are paying, you know, $50, $100. There's even an auto-injector device that costs almost $500. And there are other people getting extremely cheap prices. And that's about supply and demand and what discounts are negotiated and so forth. So the big news here is that it's not going to be covered for insurance if it's over-the-counter. So it needs to be priced at a place where people can pay for it out of pocket.
And has Emergent BioSolutions, the pharmaceutical company that makes Narcan, have they said what they're going to price it at?
Not to my knowledge. They'll have to decide that pretty soon. And the trick for them is you need to find a point where it's affordable enough, a lot of people will buy it, but it's also profitable enough that the company will keep making it, because we do have drugs sometimes that are not profitable and then they disappear, and that would be bad.
Right. And so how I guess you touched on the issue of insurance. I mean, how is this going to work? Because, I mean, my understanding right now is that if you have a prescription, like you can get it covered by Medicaid or you can maybe pay a copay of like $10. But as you mentioned, if this is available over the counter, I mean, the company still needs to turn a profit. But at the same time, like, we mentioned how many people are dying of opioid overdoses at this point. So how might the government, I guess, have to tinker with the formula there to make sure that it's priced in a way that people can still have access to this if they need it?
Yeah, so it is going to be challenging because, as you know, you can't pay for over-the-counter drugs on health insurance. I mean, the worst case scenario, let's say that the drug was so expensive that people didn't buy it at all. The government could, in the end, purchase the patent and make it a public good, or the government could try to manufacture it, like the way California's manufacturing insulin. But, you know, first, I think we should just wait and see. It's possible this will work. Perhaps it will be a nice, affordable drug like aspirin is, and it will get out there. And if the company can find that sweet spot, then we're going to be fine. But if not, yeah, the state may have to step in.
And are there concerns that some companies may opt out of carrying this? I mean, grocery stores. I mean, there exists a stigma.
Absolutely.
around addiction.
And we have that now. I mean, there are pharmacies that don't carry naloxone. There are pharmacists who don't want to give out naloxone. So those problems don't go away. And I think it's going to depend a lot on what all of us do, what we say to, our community pharmacists. You know, do we say, why is this here? Or do we say, why isn't it here? I mean, you know, we have drugs in this community. You should be carrying that as a responsible member of the community. And that problem needs to be resolved. But, you know, we can all have a place in that by, you know, communicating to our local merchants that we think this is important, that it should be available.
Well, Keith, thank you so much for coming back on the show today. I appreciate it.
Really nice to talk.
Keith Humphreys is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford. And it is the final day of KCRW's Spring Pledge Drive. Again, what are you waiting for? What are you waiting for? Donate now so you can bring more, so we can bring you more of what you love. Events, podcasts, more. How about $20 a month? Just go to kcrw.com/give, and I am joined now by the one and only Madeline Brand, making a guest appearance on her own show.
Well, I am taking a few days off for some medical leave. Nothing serious. I'll be back soon. But I just felt like this was so important to call in during this fundraiser to try to get our long-term listeners, our loyal listeners, to donate or to renew their membership or even to up your membership. Because maybe you joined a while ago and many years ago and your fortunes have improved somewhat. Perhaps it's time to take another look at your monthly donation and up it a little bit. And of course, we've got all sorts of lovely thank you gifts out over at the website at kcrw.com/give. We have brand new swag. You know, every fundraiser, Michelle, I'm just like, I want that. I can't just walk around wearing KCRW sweatshirts all day, every day.
I know, carrying KCRW totes and wearing KCRW hats. I mean, looking like a real fangirl over here.
I know. I wish there was a KCRW onesie. Oh, I would wear that. Okay, I would rock that.
Yeah, or, you know, a KCRW, like, bike suit. Like, I would really love that to go out, like, all in spandex, just KCRW logos all over me. Unfortunately, we don't have that right now, but we do have this really cool hat thing. If you give $15 a month, it's very hip. Like, you could wear this in Silver Lake for sure.
Yeah, anywhere. You can wear a hat anywhere. And it's starting to get sunny. I notice the sun is peeking out. The clouds are clearing. It's the perfect time to end our spring membership on an up note. And just look forward to warmer days, perhaps a little less rain. Fingers crossed. I can't believe I'm actually saying that.
I know. I think we've reached the point where we can say that now. We're over the weather.
We're literally saturated. All right. So we're over the weather, but we're not over KCRW because we're here like the weather all day long, every day, through thick and thin, when it's raining, when it's snowing. Is it snowing here? Sometimes it snows. Wherever you are, it might snow.
We're like the mailman. We're here.
Exactly. Sleet, snow, all sorts of distress. And also the good times, we're here. So we've been with you throughout it all. And we really need you to be with us at kcrw.com/give. We have an incentive. We have Will and Vivica Farrell. They are going to bump up your donation by $100. So whatever you give, they will bump it up by $100. So hey, take advantage of that. For us, that's free money.
Exactly.
So let us in on that action. And Michelle, you know, I don't know about you, but I think we talked a little bit about this yesterday. You and I have been in the system for a while and worked at all sorts of different radio stations. And for me, this is definitely the best station I've ever worked at. And I've worked at the network for many, many years. And this is definitely my best job. And I'm so honored to be a part of this family.
That's right. And if that's important to you, you're a member, I'm a member. Why don't you become a member at kcrw.com/give. Coming up on Press Play, the story of how Tetris escaped the Iron Curtain to become one of the most popular video games ever created.
I first encountered Tetris at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. The fourth time I'm standing in line at this to play again, I realized I was hooked on this game.
I'll speak to the man who helped get Tetris out of the Soviet Union and the inventor of Tetris himself. That's next on Press Play. Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Aloy. Even if you're not much of a video game fan, chances are you've at least played Tetris. It's one of the most popular and most successful video games ever created, with more than 500 million downloads on mobile devices. Next year marks the 40th anniversary of Tetris's invention, and the story of how it became a global phenomenon is just as captivating as the game itself. In 1984, a software engineer in the Soviet Union created Tetris as a fun side project. By word of mouth, the game started to spread, first to other Soviet bloc countries, then beyond the Iron Curtain to the West. It set off an international fight for the game's rights at the peak of the Cold War. That story is now the subject of the movie Tetris, out Friday on Apple TV+.
This game isn't just addictive. It stays with you. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Hank, only 10 other people in the world have seen what you're about to see. It's called the Game Boy.
Package it with Tetris. Can you get us the rights?
Joining us to talk about the film is the creator of the game himself, Alexey Pajitnov. And we're also joined by Hank Rogers, president of the Tetris Company, who helped bring Tetris out from behind the Iron Curtain. Welcome to Press Play, both of you.
Hi, thank you.
Hello, nice to be here.
Well, Alexey, let's start with you. You created Tetris in 1984. How did you come up with the idea for this game?
I was just a regular kind of software engineer. So one day I had an idea to make a two-player game on computer using the puzzle set called Pentomino. Those are shapes which you very similar to what you see on the screen in Game Tetris. So while I try to program it, the idea of real-time game come to me, so I forget this two-player board game and programmed made Tetris.
So after all these years, I have to ask, do you have a favorite shape in Tetris?
I love them all, that's the answer. But my favorite is J shape.
Interesting. I feel like that's most people's least favorite shape, at least, or maybe it's just my least favorite shape.
Oh, really? You don't like J?
No, I find it hard to figure out where to put it. I get overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, I see.
Hank, I want to bring you into this conversation now. So when did you first encounter Tetris?
I first encountered Tetris at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas in January of 1988.
And what was your first impression of it at the time?
My first impression was that it looked like a really simple game, which basically doesn't scare me because I play a simple looking game called Go. Black and white stones, and it looks very simple, but it's the deepest game in existence. And so the fourth time I'm standing in line at this to play again, I realized I was hooked on this game.
I want to play a clip from the film. There's a moment where Taron Egerton, who plays you in the movie, this is when he first comes across Tetris, like you said, at the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas, and he's at the time trying to sell his own game, finds his and is not very successful, but he later finds his sales assistant sort of off playing this game, and that's where he finds her.
Tracy. Yeah. Tracy, what are you doing?
How's it going? Look, I just invited this young lady over to see how our new game fares with the female audience.
Uh-huh. Sure. Come on, Tracy. I'm paying you to sell my game, not play other people.
Relax, Hank. This game's swell. What's it called?
Tetris.
So did that really happen? I know you said this is where you encountered it at the Consumer Electronics Show, but is that really how you first encountered it?
So my business was publishing games in Japan, my primary business. And so I was looking for games. That's what I always did at the Consumer Electronics Show and many other game shows in the world. And so I was going from machine to machine. So it didn't exactly happen. I didn't have a sales assistant that said swell or anything.
Maybe not down to the exact scripting, sure.
Yeah, but I wasn't. There's a lot of Hollywood in there. They had to tell a story that took a year and a half to play itself out in 2 hours. And it's a very complicated story. So I think they did an amazing job of being able to capture the tension that I went through when I ended up in the Soviet Union.
Well, so talk about that. So the movie shows you, you know, your journey to the Soviet Union to try to get licensing rights for the handheld version of this game. This meant flying to Moscow. You go on a tourist visa, not a business visa, which was pretty dangerous at the time. How prepared were you at the time to be doing business in the Soviet Union at this point in history?
The answer is not at all. I just got on a plane, and for me, it was an adventure game. I was trying to find Elorg, which it took me a couple of days to find Elorg.
Elorg is the, and explain what that is. This is basically the Soviet-run, you know, electronics company.
That's the agency which was authorized to make a trade with the foreign country. none of the entity in Soviet Union were allowed to have a deals with foreigner companies or people. So just a very certain appointed agency were able. So LORG was one of them.
So Hank, you're trying to find a LORG. You find it, then what?
Yeah, and then I'm about to walk in the door, and my interpreter says, "You can't go in there." I said, "What do you mean I can't go in there? You're on a tourist visa. You can't go in. You're not allowed to speak to anyone." And I said, "Well, I didn't come all this way to stand in front of a door and go back to Tokyo to get a visa. I'm going in." And apparently I did.
And Alexei, is this where you meet Hank for the first time?
Well, the next day, Hank announced himself in the LORG, and he showed that he is a publisher of Tetris, one of the Tetris publishers. And it was appointment, it was a meeting assigned for the next day, and they invite me. They say some kind of crazy guy come to talk about Tetris, so could you please come and assist us? That's what I did many times in the LORG, because they tried to find a good publisher for my game.
Even though you were the creator of this game, you weren't making any money off of it at the time, correct?
Correct. Well, we didn't have any kind of game industry. As a matter of fact, we didn't have even software industry. So all the software was distributed by state channel. It was no market at all.
Because it was all, I guess, state-owned, right? At least the intellectual property was, you know, the property of the Soviet government.
Yeah, even the concept of intellectual property didn't properly exist at the time.
And Hank, what was your impression of Alexei at the time?
He was when I first met him, he looked very suspicious, like, who the hell are you? And I spent, a couple of hours with eight people giving me the third degree about who I was and what I did and so on and so forth. And then I noticed him relaxing and smiling because he realized that I'm actually a game designer. I was a game designer before I was a businessman. And so then he actually had a real game designer. He likes to call us colleagues. But yeah, we were actually fellow game designers, and that gave us a bond, you know, solid bond right away.
And how were you able, I guess, to form that bond while you were there? Just because, you know, you're there, you're already breaking the law because you're there on a tourist visa instead of a business visa. You said you were in this room for 8 hours, basically being grilled.
I was in the room for a couple of hours being
couple hours.
Eight people.
Eight people. Okay.
So. And some of them probably were KGB. I didn't know who the hell they were. But Alexei came to me at the end of the meeting and said, "Let's get together afterwards," which I was surprised that he was able to do that. And he did. And he was breaking the law by inviting me to meet him outside of this setting. Well, everybody was breaking the law, I guess. But it was perestroika and glasnost. So we're supposed to be changing our ways. I mean, the Soviet Union is supposed to be changing their ways at this point.
Well, and that leads me to my next question. So all of this is happening on the eve of these two major events, one very serious, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and one less serious, the release of Nintendo's Game Boy. Talk about the confluence of those two events, Hank, and how they played into this scramble for the rights for this game at the time.
Yeah, so when I went, I had paid Robert Stein $25,000 to get me the Game Boy rights.
And Robert Stein, this was a guy, he was working for this Hungarian software company, right?
Yes. And so I thought he was working for me. And then I'd already made a sort of a handshake deal with Nintendo for Game Boy Tetris. And then Arakawa calls me, the president of Nintendo calls me, and he says, "You know, somebody else just offered me the rights to Tetris." And I go, "What? You know, how is somebody else doing this?" So I thought Stein was double dealing. And that's what prompted me to get on a plane, because he had been delaying me, like, you know, I would send him a fax once a week and he would say next week. And finally, I was, you know, when I shook hands with Arakawa, I started faxing him daily. And then he says, meet me in 2 weeks. I'll go there. I'll be there for a week before you arrive. And that just like, what the hell? Why would he do that? You know, and he didn't explain it to me why. It turns out that he had licensed the arcade rights to Tetris to Sega, or somebody had, and he hadn't gotten those rights yet. So he was licensing without, how can I say, he was licensing to the game without actually having rights.
So, you know, ultimately, Hank and Lexi, you guys have been incredibly successful, and you've also maintained a friendship since you first met in Moscow. To what extent do you think, you know, your bond has played into the game's success over these decades?
Very much so. I do strongly believe that my game is a very good game, but there is nothing really exceptional. But because we really put serious efforts in maintaining brand for such a long time, the game's still alive and that millions of people still enjoying it.
Yeah.
Our friendship is key important for that.
And Hank, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so when Alexei and I are in the same jurisdiction, like in New York or in Seattle or wherever, every other day it's a bottle of wine. And we don't talk about Tetris, we talk about all kinds of things. We're just friends. But keeping the game alive, you know, sometimes people call me Mr. Tetris and I say, no, I'm not Mr. Tetris. That's Alexei. I'm Dr. Tetris because I kept Tetris alive all these years.
And it stayed, you know, pretty true to the game that you created, Alexei. Why do you think that model has proven so successful over these years? Like, what is it about these, you know, couple shapes and aligning them in a way that makes these lines disappear? Like, what continues to compel people to play that for your 40 years?
Yeah. Speaking short, it's a mystery. Nobody really knows that. But there are lots of components in the game which are really important. First of all, it's a very simple game. It's geometry. Everybody knows geometry, and it's the same for everybody. Then everybody marks that the game has a constructive spirit rather than destroying. So the player have a feeling that he creates something on the screen, kind of. Put some order into the chaos of falling blocks.
Yeah, so I have another way of looking at Tetris. Normal games like, for example, Mario, you can play them by memory. You can actually record the button presses and have a machine play for you. Tetris, it's different every single time. So what's going on is you have to make a decision. You have to make decisions. And most people, once we get into the rhythm of life, we don't get to make decisions anymore. It's like wake up, have coffee, get dressed, go to the office, do your thing in the office, go back home, watch TV, blah, blah, blah. These are all things that we do automatically. There's no decision involved. And Tetris is all about making decisions. So every button time you press a button, you've made a decision. And these decisions in the beginning, they happen fairly slowly, but then they go faster and faster. So your brain is actually making decisions. It's like, and basically the rest of your life is sitting down and all of a sudden you're running mentally. And that is, I think, is a pleasure center.
Well, Alexei and Hank, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been such a fun conversation and it's been great to talk to you about Tetris.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Alexei Pajitnov is the creator of Tetris and Hank Rogers is president of the Tetris Company. The film Tetris is available on Apple TV Plus this Friday. A little clubby Tetris music for you on this final day of our spring pledge drive. And Steve Chiotakis is here. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Michelle. I guess it gives new meaning to the term Soviet bloc.
Yeah.
You see, it's not that
funny.
It's
I'm
not.
Done.
I'm done.
No,
we're
I'm
finished
done.
Here.
Oh, God. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So we are, this is the last day of the Spring Pledge Drive. By the way, I mean, we talk about the importance of this radio station. Now's the time to do it, right? So if you haven't done it, if you've been listening for the past few days and you're like, gosh, I wish they'd wrap this up. We are wrapping it up. We're wrapping it up today.
It's the final day.
It's the final day.
The final countdown. Now, the final cube.
Are we going to play Europe? No, we're not doing that.
No.
Please, God, no. Anyway, we're asking for your support of this radio station because now is the time to do it. You go online. It takes you 2 minutes. You fill out the information. If you've never given before, now is an especially good time to do that because you are actively participating in this radio station, in the success of this radio station, to continue to do the things that you enjoy, that you like, that you use, that you are informed by at kcrw.com/give.
That's right. Totally. kcrw.com/give. It is the final day. Donate now before it is too late. Coming up on this show, the Sklar brothers are here to talk about the particular madness of this year's March Madness tournament and Dodgers opening day tomorrow. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Aloy, in for Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
The most exciting ticket in sports right now, women's college basketball. Undefeated South Carolina takes on the game's most dynamic player, Iowa's Caitlin Clark, in this weekend's Final Four. In the men's tournament, local boys are making good, but not the Southern California team you might expect. San Diego State University is in the Final Four alongside more Cinderellas than backstage at Disneyland. Oh boy, here to talk about it and is the Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason, hosts of the podcast View from the Cheap Seats. Hi, you guys.
Hi, Michelle. Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well. So let's start with the women. Ratings for the NCAA women's tournament have been through the roof this season.
Yep.
In fact, ESPN even reported that 2.5 million people watched the Women's Elite Eight matchup between Iowa and Louisville. Is America finally, God, I beg of it, please, are we getting into women's sports?
Maybe, and maybe I would say the question is, has women's sports with players like Caitlin Clark, who I'm just going to say this, last week when I got on this show, the last thing I said was watch out for Caitlin Clark. She's maybe the most exciting player in all of the NCAA right now, men's or women's draw. And oh, she only went out and did something that has never been done in either draw. Got a 41-point triple-double. 41 points, 12 rebounds, 10 assists, or vice versa, 10 assists, 12 rebounds. She was incredible.
That is insane. I mean, yeah. I played basketball for I can't even fathom. I really just, those are insane numbers.
And it's not just, you know, for her, it's the way she scores too. She steps across midcourt and takes shots from the logo. She is in many ways a lot like Steph Curry, and like her game is like Trae Young, who plays for the Atlanta Hawks. She's exciting to watch, and exciting to watch, you know, regardless of gender, in a way that, you know, all sports fans, if you say, I haven't watched a lot of NCAA women's basketball, you watch her game and you're like, this is exciting. This is just basketball. And there's something beautiful about the fact that so many people are tuning in. And it reminds you that when there are stars, when there are ascendant stars, when you have a storyline, a great storyline, the best player in college basketball against the best team in college basketball, now you're starting to create reasons why people are going to watch. And they're predicting that the ratings for the women's Final Four will probably exceed the ratings for the men's Final Four, which is for the first time amazing.
I personally love to see it. But mm-hmm. So Iowa, this is a formidable challenge. Like you said, they are taking on the undefeated South Carolina Gamecocks this Friday night. This is a matchup everyone has been waiting for. South Carolina are the defending champions from last
That's
year.
Right.
Can Caitlin Clark and Iowa get past them?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because South Carolina's best player is a forward, 6'5", Aaliyah Boston. She's amazing. She's a senior. Caitlin Clark is a junior. Aaliyah Boston's game is inside. She's going to grind you down. She's worked on her shot from about 8 feet from the hoop, and she's just a great inside player. Caitlin Clark can light it up from, as Jay said, from three-point range, so she can score her points in bunches. And, you know, where she's averaging about 27.3 points a game, Aaliyah Boston's like around 13 or 12 or 13 points a game. So a lot of rebounds. She's a great player. The South Carolina team is so deep, and they're kind of starting to build a dynasty reminiscent of those great women's UConn teams of the Nigino Ariema coached UConn teams, and even who we Tennessee. Should mention
the first time they're not in the Final Four in the last what 20 some but a long time.
The run that he's had with those players, it's just hard. I mean, I think this also speaks to the parity maybe starting to develop in women's college basketball, is that you get a chance to see some new faces and new teams in there. And again, like Jay said, Caitlin Clark is a generational talent who, when she goes to the WNBA, and she may go after this year, she's certainly free to go after this year, or she might go next year. She will be one of the greatest WNBA players of all time. Mark it down. I said it right here on this show that she's going to go down as one of the greatest of all time. But look, the men's draw is going to be just as exciting because we have never seen this many, and they call them low seeds. So you've got a 5 seed and a 5 seed, a 4th seed and a 9 seed. If Florida Atlantic University makes it into the final, they will be the highest number, lowest seed in a championship game. The last low seed that won a championship game was Villanova in 1985, when they pulled that huge upset against number one Georgetown. And it goes down as one of the biggest upsets in all of sports.
Has this ever happened, though? I mean, where you have the highest seed being a number 4 seed in the Final Four?
It is not. And again, what Randy's saying, there are a lot of factors that are factoring into that. I mean, you didn't have perennial blue blood teams like Duke or North Carolina in there. Coach Krzyzewski, who was the longtime legendary Hall of Fame coach of Duke, he's retired. So that program is going through a transition into its new coach and its new system. Roy Williams, who was the longtime coach at North Carolina, he's no longer there. And Jimmy Boeheim stepped down from Syracuse. And so a lot of these longtime classic coaches and classic programs aren't there. And you have a lot more parity across college basketball because of NIL and because of the COVID year. Some of these teams have 20, you know, kids had get an extra year of eligibility. They got 23-year-olds playing against 18-year-olds. And even if you're a 5-star 18-year-old, if you got a 23-year-old kid who's been playing college basketball for 5-6 years, there's a different kind of mentality in those kids. And when the tournament rolls around, they've got so much more college experience under their belts. And we're seeing lower seeded teams upset higher seeded teams. And we're seeing the least chalky Final Four we've ever seen.
Among them, San Diego State Aztecs. Do they have a fighting chance here?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, because they've sort of staked their claim on defense. They're a great defensive team. And if they're going to stop you defensively, they will keep the game to a low. They're winning their games in the 50s. Whereas, you know, you're seeing other teams, even like we said, we were talking about the women's game. You know, Caitlin Clark, the Iowa team, put up 91 points or 94 points in their last game. So you have an opportunity here to see a very low scoring game. And when it's low scoring, and anybody can win that game. So yeah, they can muck it up. And I love the coach of San Diego State, Brian Dutcher. He was an assistant with Steve Fisher at the University of Michigan back in 1989 when those Michigan teams won, and in the early 90s when the Fab Five were there. So he knows what it's like to be on a coaching staff that makes a deep run. He's been there. So he can say to his team, I've been to this game before. He can calm them down. Now, look, UConn is the highest ranked team. They're 4th, and they're pretty dominant, but I'm telling you, Florida Atlantic, watch out for them. They've won 34, 35 games this year. They're an incredible team and built for this tournament.
And Miami, you can't count out Miami. Miami was down 10 points to Texas late in the second half, came back, held on and win. They're like Rasputin. You cannot kill them. And they are they're a fun team to watch, and no one expected them to be in the final.
As a 5th seed, yeah.
All right, real quickly, tomorrow, Dodgers opening day, a very different lineup than we've seen recently. What can we expect for the season?
Well, Julio Urias is going to be on the mound, and he's been
incredible the last year. 17-7 last year as a starting pitcher, 20-3 in 2021. The guy is
dominant.
He's an ace. And you still have Clayton Kershaw, and you got Dustin May. Hopefully he'll come back. He had a kind of an injury riddled year last year. So you've got Gonsolin, who's a little nicked up right now, but you've got a good pitching staff. And then you've got a core of hitters.
Winners. Mookie Betts. Mookie Betts is a winner.
Freddie Freeman, J.D. Martinez. You got great hitters and players. I think
lots to look forward to.
Lots to look forward to for the Dodgers this year.
All right. Randy and Jason Sklar, the Sklar brothers. Check out their sports podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Before I let you go, though, and speaking of pitching, got to throw it out again. This is the last minute of our spring pledge drive. Please, KCRW.com. Let's do it. KCRW.com/give. You guys are members, right?
We are members. We give. And we also get the behind the scenes look at how many people work so hard to put these shows on. And you're giving not just to the on-air hosts, and you're giving to the people behind the scenes.
I'm going to say this. Every time we do this show, so many people reach out to us on social media and whatnot and said, I heard you on KCRW. So all of you who are listening to us right now, if you haven't donated yet, if you haven't given, now's the time. I'm talking directly to you. Give right now, because this show is so great. The shows they do on KCRW are so great. It's worth giving.
Right. Your donations make the Sklars, having the Sklars on our show possible. They make our show possible. Again, kcrw.com/give. Randy and Jason, thank you so much. That's going to do it for us on Press Play today. I'm Michelle Aloy. I'll see you tomorrow.